spits, or sorry, you throw it into a statistical analysis, and out spits some data for you to look at. And generally what's happening is you're able to correlate species with the kinds of conditions that they live in. So for example, today if there's a species A that lives in the lake and it really likes warm conditions.
Right.
And then there's species B, it really likes the cold conditions. So you can look through this whole profile and you can
sort of get a profile, sort of.
You get a profile, you get to see what's going on, and you're looking at the historical
sort of like telling a story of these.
That's right, telling a story. Oh, wow, maybe global climate change happened here. Or, sorry, maybe some climate change was happening here because species B was dominating. It's the cold water species. It really likes cold water. Didn't see A here very much at all. So you can get this history. And what was really important about this particular approach is that we were using it to validate climate change models. So the better that you can hindcast, in other words, so you can look at historical data, and if you can hindcast it, that means, you know, you can take these algal assemblages and you're correlating it to these conditions. Mm-hmm.
And say, this happened 1,000 years ago.
That's right. And so the better you can hindcast, because you've got this data set, the better you can forecast.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, so the more data that you have supporting your model. Yeah. So this was really important for climate change, and it was also really important for acid rain back in the 70s.
Right. So how did you get from all this super interest, like super intense work with the water and all these nano organisms and stuff to what I like to know you as, because your handle on Twitter and Instagram is Gypsy, Queen Gypsy B, I think I got that right.
Gypsy B.
To bees. How did you get from one to the other?
Right. Well, yeah. I'm sorry. I did really drag that explanation out, didn't I?
It's all right. I liked the explanation.
Well, there were various jobs and children involved in my life, and then I ended up writing a review article for Bob Wildfong, who happens to be the executive director of Seeds of Diversity Canada,
cool.
And he lives here in Waterloo. And I wrote a review article for him. He really liked it, and it was on a very special kind of technology with bees. And so then he happened to receive a grant, which was able to employ me for, eventually, we stretched it out with other grants for 7 years. So I was able to be the pollination outreach coordinator for Seeds of Diversity Canada. And Seeds of Diversity Canada spun off the Canadian Organic Growers over 30 years ago. And it's a national nonprofit charitable organization that's dedicated to the conservation of agricultural and horticultural biodiversity, to create resilient and sustainable agriculture and food systems. So biodiversity, just for your listeners there, might not be totally familiar.
It's sort of over my head too. So.
Okay, perfect. So it's really a compound word. It means biological diversity. And it honestly just refers to the amazing diversity of plants and animals that we have here on Earth.
Right. And would that, so do you focus on all animals in that biosphere, or would you focus predominantly on, you know, the water species or bees, or what would you focus on when you were studying with them?
When I was with Seeds of Diversity?
Yes,
I was focused on the biodiversity of pollinators, which are animals that pollinate.
Okay, so is that just bees, or are bees the only ones that pollinate?
Great question. No, they aren't. So So what happens here is, maybe we should just back up a teeny weeny eensy bit.
All right, yes, let's back up.
We're going to start with, what in the world is pollination?
Yeah, okay.
Okay. So pollination is a vital first step in plant reproduction. Basically, what we're talking about is plant sex here.
Okay. Ooh, yeah, naughty.
I know. Crazy. So as you might know, mm-hmm. plants happen to have male and female organs that are located within the plant's flowers.
Okay.
Okay, so something called pollen. Have you ever taken a dandelion and rubbed it on your face or somebody else's face?
Yep.
And you're left with this yellow powdery residue?
Yeah, I have two younger brothers. I've done that to them before and they've done that to me before.
Okay. So that is pollen. That residue, that powder is pollen. And it's the male genetic material of plants. Pollen needs to get to the female part of the flower.
Right.
That is exactly what pollination is. It's all about getting that pollen to where it needs to go. And so it's that transfer of pollen. How does that happen? So there are ways, there are physical ways. Wind and water are mm-hmm. two natural physical ways that plants will do this. So, for example, what we call staple cereal crops, such as barley, rice, oats, wheat, corn, and rye, these right. are all types of plants that only need the wind to accomplish pollination. So wind pollinated plants make pollen that is really light in weight and small in size so that it carries easily through the air, and the plant produces a lot of it, but much of the pollen produced is wasted as it tries to reach its destination. So the other important thing about this wind pollination system is that pollen from plants that rely on winds are the ones to blame for allergies, not goldenrod.
So it's not goldenrod, it's called I get sniffles once in a while.
That the goldenrod, usually in the late summer and autumn, what happens here, and I'm going, it's important. Goldenrod blooms at the same time as ragweed. So it's what we call hedgerows. Okay. So back in the day, hedgerows were maybe it was 10 feet of just brush, of foliage, of habitat. So, yeah, when I say habitat, yeah, too, by the way, I should define that. That means, you know, natural plants. Places. We're talking about trees, shrubs, vines, ground cover, native grasses, wildflowers. That's all.
Anything that would grow naturally.
Exactly. Exactly. You got it. Yeah, so So those are monocultures. That's what we call a monoculture, when it's you're growing a lot of just the same thing. And in particular, corn, if you'll remember, is one of those wind-pollinated plants.
Right.
It doesn't provide nectar.
So the bees can't feed off the corn, so it's sort of just...
They will starve if corn is their only source of food, because it only grows for a certain time in the season, and the pollen isn't quite as nutritious. As pollen that's meant for pollinators.
So what would be some good plants for pollinators that farmers could grow?
Well, I can get into that part
A little later. All right.
Perfect. Sorry, I'm long-winded.
It's all right. I like that you're long-winded. This is good. Okay.
So we've got to stay back to, you were asking about, so honeybees going extinct, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's get back to that. Circle. Okay. Yeah. Corn. Bad for bees.
That's right.
Pollen.
So we're going, what we're doing right now is delving into all the reasons that all bees are on the decline. Yes. And so habitat is one of those things. And so then we also have chemical use. So we're talking pesticides.
Yeah.
Well, or insecticides. Bees happen to be insects. And insecticides kill insects. So that's having an effect. There are also pests and disease. We've got climatic shifts going on due to global climate change. So, for example, the time of emergence for a pollinator from hibernation and the time that its native plants will bloom for food are orchestrated to coincide, but researchers are starting to see some timing differences here. And another factor that is affecting the populations of bees and such are invasive species. So I'm referring to both plants, which we call flora, and animals, which we call fauna. So, for example, non-native bees can displace native populations of bees, and we see that happening in Patagonia right now, actually. Hmm. Yeah, so those are the reasons why they're on the decline. Yeah, so that applies to both honeybees and other bees. Now, the media, the media has sort of misunderstood these particular nuances that I'm about to explain.
Okay.
Honeybees really suffered losses. So what beekeepers do in every year is they will look at how many bees died over the winter.
Right.
And so they report that as their winter die-off. And in Canada, for many, many years, it's on average, it's about 15% of your bees might die due to just natural causes and maybe a little
bit
of weather. They have strategies for working with that.
Right. So not a huge amount, but still, you know.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's going to be something.
Yeah, but 15%, it's not a huge loss.
That's right. Okay. But headlines started appearing when beekeepers were losing 60%, 50%, and over the past winter, some Canadian beekeepers lost up to 70%, even more.
Oh, my.
Even more. Yeah. So that's alarming for them, and of course that affects them. I have never met anyone who's kept bees that doesn't have an absolute love for them, and so they're really quite devastated when this happens. This is an agricultural, this is due to the agricultural practices. So what we actually saw happening a lot was when these crops, so when corn was being planted in the spring, we would see a lot of honeybees dying off as well.
Right.
And that was because of, they get planted with a pesticide. It's a systemic pesticide. It means it's coated right onto the seed of corn, and then it grows right into the tissue of the corn. And so it's there, and if a pest, so-called pest, will come and eat it, then it will die.
Then it'll just kill the pest instantly, mm-hmm. regardless of what might be.
That's right.
Okay.
But there's a lot of dust that was kicked up by these corn planting machines. And there's a lot of rogue seed that gets into the environment. And so 96% of this pesticide would go into the waterways, it goes into the soil, it stays there for a very, very long time. This is why you were seeing headlines.
Yeah.
Was mainly due to these sorts of occurrences. So that was very unfortunate. It is very unfortunate for beekeepers, for honeybees. However, there's an industry built around this. And the industry is such that you can replace your bees. You can divide up your own colonies, any remaining colonies. You can buy more bees. You can buy more queens. The industry is set up to perpetuate honeybees. Honeybees as a species are absolutely not going extinct, according to the IUCN.
Yay.
The International Union of Conservation for Nature, which is a global organization that's dedicated to determining such designations. However, what we do know is that a quarter to one-third of our North American bumblebees are in fact threatened. They are at risk.
Okay, so it's not the honeybees that are going extinct. They're fine. It's the bumblebees that are going extinct.
Bumblebees and other bees, what we call native bees. Because here's the interesting thing about honeybees. Honeybees came to Canada about 400 years ago with the colonists. So they landed in Jamestown, Virginia, as an agricultural tool.
Oh, wow.
They came along, you know, because what are honeybees? So let me ask you.
All right, ask away.
When you picture a bee, what do you picture?
Black and yellow, bzzz, wings, fluffy on the back,
okay.
Stinger.
Stinger, yeah.
Yeah.
And do they make honey?
Some do, some just annoy me.
Okay, yeah.
Most make honey, yeah.
Okay, cool.
And some just buzz around stinging and annoy.
Right. All right, so honeybees, now this is anecdotally what we find, we being people who talk to people about pollination conservation.
Right.
So I don't know of any studies that have been done out there, but what we find anecdotally is that, you know, we have this amazing, long cultural history of fascination with honeybees.
Right.
Like, we have cave paintings. I'm going to use a conservative estimate. Let's go back 8,000 years at least. I've seen estimates that are longer, but that's a debate over their dating methods. Anyway, at least 8,000 years ago, we were robbing bees of their honey.
Oh, wow.
We see this in cave paintings. And by 3,000 years ago, we were keeping bees artificially.
In artificial hives and things like that?
That's right. Like, so for example, in Egypt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So we have this long, long history, and we're fascinated by it because, honestly, they are amazing creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very social bee. They raise, what that means, these social bees raise their young together.
Huh.
So the thing about this is that we actually, so honeybees are one species. We actually have 20,000 species of bees in the world.
Whew.
We have about 4,000 in North America. And in Canada, we have over 850 native bees.
Oh, wow.
So we're talking like mason bees, carpenter bees, sweat bees, mining bees, bumblebees, squash bees. There are so many different kinds of bees.
I bet you could probably name most of them, or if not all of them.
No, definitely not all.
The most?
But some.
All right.
Yeah.
Probably more than me.
Probably. Well, yes.
Definitely more than me.
DJ Hacksaw. Mm-hmm. So these other bees are what we call native bees.
Right.
For the most part. We also have other bees that have been introduced, that have slipped in by accident, of course.
But the majority are native.
Yes, majority are. And the majority of these bees are what we call solitary bees as opposed to social bees. What that means is that it's just one single solitary female who is raising the next generation. She doesn't have the help of her sisters like the honeybees.
Right. So it's just one sort of queen bee idea?
Yes.
Okay, and she's just like, they're all my kids, I'm raising them all.
That's right.
Okay.
Exactly. And so she doesn't have man-made hives to live in. She is living either in the ground, so 70% of our native solitary bees nest in the ground, and that other 30%, they nest in cavities. So they might nest, for example, bumblebees will nest in the jumble of old stone walls, or abandoned mouse burrows, or they'll just, like a big clumps of grass.
It may be like a dead tree or something where there's a hole in it. Does that work too?
Yes. I believe there's evidence has been found recently of that, which is, now that's generally what a honeybee, a wild honeybee colony would do, is occupy a dead tree.
Okay.
So that it has a hollow, it has protection.
But it's mostly most native bees in Canada live in underground?
They're living in underground, or they're living in cavities such as stems. It's on a smaller scale here. So you're talking like raspberry stems or elderberry and sumac. These sorts of things are really excellent for providing cavities where bees will nest. And that's really good. Mm. So your friend actually was absolutely spot on when they said that there were seven bees on the
endangered species list.
Yeah, so now what this list is, this is a list of species at risk.
Right.
So, you have a federal list and you have a provincial list as well.
Okay.
But, you know, let's just focus on the federal, and we do indeed have seven bees on there. One is actually has been listed as endangered.
Okay.
So that's the rusty patch bumblebee. So she was last seen in Pinery Provincial Park in 2008. Mm. There are pockets of the rusty patch in the U.S., but,
not so much in Canada.
Not as much in Canada, no.
Okay. So that's only one on the endangered species list.
What about
the other six?
Yeah, the other six have been, they're recommended, and they've been recommended to for protection, but they await designation by the environmental minister of the environment and climate change.
Okay, so six are still iffy, but there's one that's actually on.
Yeah, one that's actually on. Like one that is protected, it has measures in place. The other six are waiting for that protection. But they've been designated, they've been identified, which is really important.
Okay.
So, so those are the species that we really need to be concerned about. And maybe your listeners are wondering, well, what can we do?
Mm-hmm. What can we do?
Well, we can do a lot of things, but honestly, the absolute best thing that you can do is to plant for them.
And what can we plant for them?
Well, all right, well, let's get into that. Just to back up a teeny weeny bit, there are three basic needs that need to be met.
Okay.
If you want to help bees and other pollinators. And that's the great thing, by the way. You know, bees are a gateway bug. So, to me...
Don't do drugs, do gateway bugs.
That's right. These bees and, you know, like the bee issue...
Yeah.
...is a great foot in the door for all ecosystems. So once you're protecting some habitat or creating habitat for bees... You know, it expands to other creatures. It's an interconnected web of life, right? Everything is...
My brain just went to the Circle of Life song from...
Oh, there you go.
Lion King.
Okay, perfect. Perfect. Yeah, so it helps a lot of things. Anyways, three basic needs to help bees. You want to provide them with adequate food, which means pollen and nectar. And you want to give them safe nest sites. And you want to protect them from pesticides. Okay. So, and by the way, you know I'm talking fast and a lot. If any of our listeners out there are wanting to look at this information on their own and maybe at a more leisurely pace, I would like to recommend a website that they can go to.
Recommend away.
Okay. So, seeds.ca, so S as in...
Sierra.
Sierra, right.
Let's go for the alphabet.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, Sierra, Echo, Echo, Roger.
D.
No.
I want a D.
Seeds?
Seeds.
Sierra, Echo, Echo, Delta, Sierra.
Perfect. So seeds.ca.
Right.
/pollination/resources.
I'm not going to spell out those last, dude,
but... No, yeah.
So that's Sierra, Echo, Echo, Delta, Sierra.ca?
Yeah.
All right.
Beautiful. That's perfect. Yeah, so there are all the resources, any resources that I mentioned will be likely there. So if we want to keep in mind that adequate food means pollen and nectar from flowers, ideally what you want to do is select a mix of pollen and nectar providing plants so that there are blooms during the entire growing season. And not just during the summer when so many people have things growing.
Right.
You want to think about those shoulder seasons like early spring right now and late autumn.
Right, and when there might not be so many
as
things
much.
Grown.
When people don't really think about it, you know? Yeah. And you can think of, we really try to encourage you to think about perennial native plants at all canopy levels. So, I mean, obviously, if your listeners are students, they're not going to be going out there and growing fruit and nut-bearing trees and shrubs and wildflowers and herbs and native grasses and ground covers and vines, but they could think about... And here's something for your Laurier students.
Ooh.
You know, something that's fun to consider are, how about some blooms in your school colors of purple and gold?
Ooh,
right?
That does sound fun.
Yeah. So as far as purple flowers go, asters. Asters are awesome. So native asters, you see them growing all the time, usually in conjunction, actually, with goldenrod. And there's your gold, right?
Right.
So, mm-hmm. I mean, even if you just grew... or allowed or encouraged to grow asters and goldenrod.
Asters and goldenrod.
Boom! You've got two, those are two autumn plants there.
Laurier Students Union. Yeah. I know at least one of you listens to this, Zamar. Come on! I had him on a couple weeks ago.
Oh, nice.
I know he listens to this, so we can butt him about that.
That's excellent.
We have an expert here. She endorses this. Let's get it done.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So there's things like giant blue hyssop. Even though it says it's blue, it looks purple to me. There's ironweed, there's vervain, there's wild geranium, wild blue phlox. So those are all like on the purple side of things. And
right.
There are more too, but these are some native ones that I just had at, that I made note of. And some yellow ones are Coreopsis. The gray-headed coneflower is a great native flower. It actually has yellow petals.
Okay, I was going to say gray-headed coneflower.
I know,
hmm.
It doesn't sound quite right. But think of a purple coneflower.
Yeah.
Most people, you know, Echinacea, you know, the plant that's supposed to help you when you have a cold.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Something
so just,
that I need right now.
Oh, yeah, there you go. So just replace, yeah, so instead of it being purple, it would have yellow. Other yellow flowers are Jerusalem artichokes, and these are really neat because they're native and they're actually an edible food as well. So they grow a tuber that you can eat.
Hmm.
And it's really good for diabetic people because it lacks starch and it has inulin instead, which is a great fiber. Yeah, so those are some ideas that you can do. So, you know, if your listeners are students, maybe they can take this information home to their parents too.
Right. And if they were to take this information home to their parents, and say their parents have, you know, somewhere that they can grow maybe trees or vines or
yes.
whatever, what could they grow?
Yeah, okay. Well, one of the main points I really want to emphasize here are native plants.
Native plants.
Why? Why in the world would we care about native plants? Well,
yeah,
so
I think some non-native plants look very nice.
They do. And I don't want to shame anybody or
put them down
discourage.
For
yeah. Yeah, we all have our, but what I'm telling you are the best practices.
Right.
So I'm just going to give you the facts and you get to make up your own minds, of course. So one of the things about native plants is that they've grown up or they've co-evolved with our local pollinators. And what that means, it means that these native plants are supporting the needs of our local pollinators and wildlife. Yeah. And so native plants have adapted to our local growing conditions. And this is so important with respect to climate change.
Right.
So for example, our native plants are going to be able to evolve and adapt much better than an ornamental or exotic plant will.
Right.
Yeah. So the other great thing about native plants is that they require much less care. They require little, if no water, once they're established.
Because they already know the climate that they need to grow up in, so they're like, oh, okay, I know I can get this much water from X, Y, and Z.
That is absolutely correct, yeah. And so, and often these native plants are drought tolerant. I want to talk about some tall grass species in a minute, but before I do, I just want to mention that, for example, again, these are just best practices, so some ornamentals or hybrid plants don't offer nectar and or pollen. You have to keep that in mind. So things
yeah.
like double-bloomed roses, for example, or double-flowered plants, like you see these, they have little wildlife value because the bees and other insects can't access the nectar and pollen.
So they have them, it's just the bees can't really get to it. So.
Yeah. So what we find, okay, so for example, by the way, there are many, many lists on that website that reference.
Right.
So
seeds.ca/pollination/resources.
You got it.
Yes, we got there.
Yeah, so there are many plant lists there that I do refer you to. And also something that's really great is that this organization called Pollinator Partnership Canada has provided, have developed some eco-regionally appropriate plant lists.
Hmm.
So, for example, here in Waterloo, in Kitchener, we are in the Manitoulin Lake Simcoe ecoregion.
Right.
And so there's a booklet that you can get online for free, and they list a lot of plants, and they list a lot of these practices as well.
And those would be ones that aren't just local to Ontario, but are native to Waterloo, and they would recommend growing for Waterloo, and those would be different to Cambridge, to Toronto, to Ottawa. Yes?
Yeah, well, actually, Ottawa would be in a different ecoregion. I think Cambridge is in the same ecoregion.
Hmm.
But what's really interesting, though, Quinn, is that, or did you have
something? It's all right. Since one half does the other.
Yeah, is that This ecoregion does include some very small stands of what's called Carolinian forest or mixed forest and remnants of tall grass communities. So tall grass prairies and tall grass savannas are some of the most endangered ecological communities in North America. And many of these native assemblages tolerate a wide range of temperatures and they are drought tolerant. So what's really interesting is that up to 65% of these plants' biomass, so most of their physical actual plant, is located underground in these extensive root systems, allowing some of these plants, according to Tallgrass Ontario's website, to sink carbon at the same rate as forests.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So
we need this tall grass, essentially.
We need these species. So when I say tall grass, you might be thinking actually grass. Yes, there are five particular native tall grass species.
Right.
But there are also a lot of wildflowers, and so some of the ones I've already mentioned, like ironweed and the hyssop and
all the purple and
vervain.
Gold lines,
yes.
For laurier.
Yeah, some of those, they are. Now, just for your listeners' entertainment, for the listeners themselves, or if they want to take this information home to their parents, one of the things that I recommend, see, the thing is, when it comes to native wildlife gardening, you really want to mimic the natural ecosystem, and therefore you want to be kind of as wild as possible. You want to leave your deadfall. That is providing habitat for these bees and other pollinators and other insects. So, you know, you want to leave your deadfall. You really don't want to clean up your garden in the spring,
fall, winter.
In the fall, that's right. Because you inadvertently you could be putting pollinators at your curbside. You're especially cleaning up your raspberry stems, you know, if you can cut them down to maybe 15, 18 centimeters, that's great. You can leave that if you can't leave the whole thing. One of the things that I recommend is that if you don't really like the idea of this messy kind of look, you might consider having a mullet garden.
What's that?
Well, based on the characterization of this hairstyle, right? Business in the front and party in the back. Then maybe you want to allocate your pollinator paradise to your backyard.
Right.
And that's where you can get all funky and crazy and just.
And then keep the nice and tidy stuff in the front.
Yeah.
Okay.
Although preferably not just grass, because grass doesn't really give off a lot of oxygen. And, you know, there are things.
Nutrients
that can do it.
And pollen.
That's
and stuff.
Right. That's right. You got it. That is absolutely correct. Yeah, so I just wanted to say something, though, about laurier itself.
Shoot.
If you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
You know, you've got a really great university here that's really community-oriented. And last year, we noticed that Laurier's sustainability office was fundraising. They were trying to fundraise to, you know, they actually had a little apiary. They have a little two little honeybee hives.
I think I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, on campus. Now, it's actually at their Northdale campus.
I think I saw something about that just as, as you know, my dad works with Laurier stuff, so I think I probably saw something about it on Facebook.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So, so they were fundraising to add these honeybees, and, well, one of the main things that I didn't really mention to you that I didn't get around to talking about with honeybees, because there's so much to talk about.
There is.
Is that a honeybee hive, how many individual bees do you think are in a honeybee hive?
I think you told me this. I originally said 800, but I think you said something closer to, I want to say 300,000 or something around there.
Okay, well, we're going to narrow it down.
Okay.
We're going to hit it. So, in the off season, so right about now, you've probably got about 20 to 30,000 individual bees in a honeybee hive, if they're still alive. If
so essentially you've got the population of a small town in a honeybee hive.
That's right.
Oh,
you
wow.
got it. Now, in this peak of summer, when blooms are blooming and bees are buzzing and honey's getting made and all kinds of great things are happening and the colony is reproducing like crazy, you could have 50 to 80,000 bees in that hive.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, when we're talking about a bumblebee colony, we're talking about maybe 50 to maybe 300 bees.
Right.
And from there, it just gets smaller. And we don't have that many other social insects like honeybees and bumblebees. We have a lot of solitary bees. So what you want to think about is how much habitat and how much forage you have. How much, remember, in this case, we're talking about the noun, so we're going to talk about blooms with pollen and nectar.
Right.
Well, if we already know that in a city, we're limited when it comes to habitat for this mm-hmm. kind of forage.
Yeah.
So putting a honeybee hive down in the city and expecting it
to flourish
is a little bit crazy. I think once upon a time,
that would have been a good idea because we had more habitat and more food or not, but now
we don't. And so what's happening is some studies out there are showing us that when you have too much of a concentration, you get out competition. So they are out competing. You know, obviously, let's just go with the conservative estimate of 20,000 bees in a hive.
Right.
Obviously, you're going to have a detrimental effect on your smorgasbord resources. Right?
Yeah.
And these native bees are going to maybe have a little bit harder time getting some of this.
Some of their resources.
Yeah. Now, they partition resources, which means, they have preferences. So, for example, honeybees don't like squash pollen. Hmm. But in general, when your resource is already limited, you might run into some troubles.
Correct.
So, the Sustainability Office was trying to increase their apiary, and my friend Jennifer Marshman, who's a PhD candidate here at Laurier with the Center for Sustainable Food Systems, we approached them and suggested there might be more sustainable ways to support pollinators like bees, especially about establishing habitat. And so you know what? They were so amazing, the Sustainability Office.
Right.
And they heard our arguments and they chose not to increase their
behavior. Yay! Yay.
Ooh. Yeah.
What's the sad note?
Sadder note, unfortunately, their two honeybees didn't make it over winter, so they will no longer have those honeybees there. Aww. Yeah.
That's sad.
But they're doing great things.
Yay! So, unfortunately, we do have another show after us, so I think we're going to have to wrap it up, unfortunately.
Okay.
So, are there any last words you want to get out there, or anything you want to get out to the crowd?
I would like to. I'm so sorry. My gosh, I talk so much.
It's all right. I think this is this is probably the best episode we've had, because I hate usually having to play music during my interviews.
Oh,
I want to talk
okay.
forever, so this is probably my best episode so
okay.
far, so thank you.
Okay. But can I make a request about
it? Yes, of
okay.
course.
But I do want to just mention a couple things in case all right. any of our listeners are
fire away.
Crazy interested. So one of the things that I like to mention is that, I'll quickly mention that both Kitchener and Waterloo are both bee cities. So
Yay.
This is a movement that's going across Canada. Basically what it means is that the municipality has recognized that really important link that we have, which I didn't even get to talk about, which is food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the link between pollinators and food. We didn't even get to talk about why pollinators are important. They're really important for food. They're really important for wildlife food. They're really important for recreational landscapes. Let's think about plants that provide us with oxygen, plants
mm-hmm.
that provide us with erosion control. There's all kinds of reasons that they're so important. And so as a bee city, one of the things that bee cities do is they recognize this interdependence that we have on pollinators and plants. And we create habitat, and we educate people, and we celebrate. And so we typically celebrate what's called Pollinator Week in the third week of June.
Mm-hmm.
And
third week in June.
Yeah, third week in June. So in particular, I just want to bring an event to the attention of your listeners, and that's Tuesday, June 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Kitchener Public Library, the main branch on Queen Street. We will be having a little film festival.
Ooh.
We have three little films, and we'll be chatting and having a good time and buzzing about that. And if anybody is super interested, I just wanted to let them know that on Wednesday, April 17th, I mean, obviously a lot of your listeners are going to be mired in exams at this time.
But we all deserve a little break.
Yeah, but maybe there's some staff listening. I don't know. Wednesday, April 17th at that same venue at Kitchener Public Library, Main Branch, Queen Street at 7 p.m. I will be giving a talk which is called The World of Pollinators, What's the Buzz?
Love it. So again, those dates are April 17th,
that's
your
right.
talk.
April 17th at 7 at KPL and Tuesday, June 18th at 6:30 at KPL.
Beautiful. So go out, watch some good movies, and hear a great talk. And what was that song you wanted to hear?
Well, you know what? I think that what the world needs now is love. And if you can get that by Cat Power.
World.
If you can get Cat Power's version.
Cat Power.
That would be awesome.
Needs. My.
Oh,
my no, I'm just not good at typing. Cat Power. I found it!
Fantastic.
What the world needs now.
Thanks, DJ Hexa.
You're very welcome. Tune in next week, everyone. We'll see you later.
What the world needs now is love, sweet love. It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love. For everyone, Lord, we don't need another mountain.